From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, newly revealed emails show GM ordered 500,000 replacement ignition switches nearly 2 months before telling the government there was a problem.
It was considered an urgent order. In fact, the order caught Delphi by such surprise that Delphi asked, is this a firm order?
Plus, birds on Prozac? Drugs and other chemicals from our personal care products are being found further out into the Great Lakes than ever before.
Even at low doses, some of these chemicals, not all of them, but some of them do have an impact at lower concentrations.
And Red Wing Hall of Famer Chris Chelios will be here to talk about his new memoir, Made in America, and celebrating with the Stanley Cup.
You know, when Sylvester Stallone shows up to your party, you know it's a good one.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Think for a moment about what happens when you take a prescription drug, let's say metformin for diabetes or perhaps Prozac. Your body uses the drug, but traces will undoubtedly be excreted from your body right into the toilet, flushed away, something most of us likely don't think twice about. But more and more scientists are saying we had better think about it. That's because drugs and other personal care product chemicals are being found further out into the Great Lakes than ever before. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we talk about how the everyday medicines we're taking are leaving their mark on the environment. But first, emails just released in a court case revealed that General Motors ordered 500,000 replacement ignition switches nearly 2 months before reporting the defective switch problem to the government, a defect that's been blamed for 30 deaths. Jeff Bennett broke this story for the Wall Street Journal. Jeff Bennett is with us now. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
How did these emails come to light?
The emails are part of a court case that is now being heard in New York, where those who have either sustained injuries or their cars have had an economic loss because of the ignition switch recall are suing General Motors to reclaim monies they believe are owed to them.
And who were the emails between?
The emails are between a GM contract worker who works at Menlo Worldwide Logistics and auto parts maker Delphi Automotive PLC. What it shows is that Menlo, on the orders of General Motors, put in an order to Delphi for 500,000 ignition switch parts on December 18th.
And an urgent order?
It was considered an urgent order. In fact, the order caught Delphi by such surprise that Delphi asked, is this a firm order? Is this really going through? And the next email that came back said, yes, it's a firm order. It's an urgent order. And we need you to tell us how you're going to fill this. And so what we have here are emails that occurred on December 18th that up until now have never been made public either by GM in its chronology that it filed with safety regulators earlier this year or by an internal investigation that GM had conducted by attorney Anton Valukas.
And the cost of this, what, $2.8 million something for these 500,000 ignition replacement switches?
Yeah, they basically had gotten a price from Delphi that it was going to cost about that much money and just kind of went through the workings of a regular part order. However, again, it just questions if GM has said up until now that really we didn't really make any big moves on the recall until a meeting on January 31st. And then we notified the Traffic Safety Administration on February 7th of a recall. Well, now you have these emails that show some steps were taken as early as December 18th.
And we know that GM Chief Executive Mary Barra, at the time, she was head of product development and purchasing. And wouldn't one expect that the head of purchasing would get word of a big unbudgeted purchase? Yeah, $2.8 million. That had to cause a blip on a lot of radar screens.
You would think. Again, she was in charge of global product development, purchasing, and supply. It may have been under her. Again, there are no emails directly that point back to how far up the chain it went. GM has said people did make decisions within its organization without letting other people know. So we just don't know how far up it went. It just, again, though, it's kind of interesting that a part order, something that, as you said too, is a unique part order goes through the system and it doesn't seem to kind of get the attention of those that kind of follow this information.
And what does it say to you, Jeff, that it's a contract worker, you know, not someone higher up in the GM food chain, but this contract worker placing what is, you know, a big head-turning order?
Well, we checked it out, and it does kind of follow the standard operating procedure for this order to come in and this contract worker to go ahead and place it. However, what is missing and hopefully will come out sometime is who approved that order and how did it all trickle down. So it is kind of, again, a gray area, and this is the big thing with GM. It's such a large organization that you just don't know how things went up the chain and how far up they did go.
Jeff, any reaction from General Motors, the government, or from Delphi to your story?
Well, GM did put out a statement this morning saying that the emails are further confirmation that its system needed reform and that the company has done so, that it has reorganized its entire safety investigation and decision process, has hired more investigators internally. So GM is saying that it has taken steps. However, you have others like Senator Blumenthal, who has questioned GM from the beginning on this, wondering how these emails were not reported publicly, and it raises concerns for him that this information was not shared. So questions for Congress, and big thing is that these emails could prove as fodder for lawyers that are suing General Motors.
Jeff Bennett broke the story of the fact that General Motors ordered new switches long before the recall. He writes for The Wall Street Journal. Jeff, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
The taggers who leave graffiti on other people's buildings and walls may view it as expressing themselves, but the owners of those buildings and walls see that graffiti as a big, expensive headache. Earlier this year, Dan Gilbert asked his employees for tips to lead to IDing whomever spray-painted graffiti on the side of one of his downtown Detroit buildings. He was mad, and the tips led to the arrest of three teenage girls from Grosse Pointe. Well, Ann Arbor has come up with a creative way to deal with unwanted graffiti, the Juvenile Graffiti Removal Project. Yep, kids caught spray-painting serve their community service time by cleaning up the graffiti. It's the brainchild of Sergeant Thomas Hickey of the Ann Arbor Police Department. Welcome.
Thanks for the invite.
Just to be clear, we are not talking about something that that a building owner pays for, something that he or she wants, but we're talking about spraying stuff on, like the graffiti that had Dan Gilbert just incandescent with rage.
Yes, exactly. It was the same graffiti that was on the Ann Arbor Art Train, cost probably close to $70,000 or $80,000 to clean that up.
So in essence, I'm a kid, I get caught making my mark
right
on a wall or building, what happens?
Well, the system is, of course, like even the adult system, it's quite lengthy. But at some point when they go to court and there's restitution, they may have to do restitution for the businesses. And then most of them have a community service component. And that's where I come in. And so rather than having them do something else in the city, they actually spend Sundays with me cleaning up the graffiti and actually then utilizing their community service hours.
All right. I have to hear, what's it like when you're out there on Sundays? Here I am. I was expressing myself, and now I get to spend my Sundays with Sergeant Hickey.
Right. Well, the first, and I was sharing this story with one of your staff members, the first day I did it, I bought a wagon, and I had all my graffiti removal products walking down Main Street, and they're cleaning off mailboxes and some of the utility boxes. Now, it probably takes a matter of minutes to put this spray paint on, and I had little graffiti removal wipes, like a hand wipe, and they were basically, took about an hour to clean this off. And so they were seeing the perspective of a few minutes of, in their eyes, fun and quite a bit of work to take this off. It's also, it is very expensive for me to even buy the product to remove it. It's quite expensive, so.
I'm interested in, certainly those who subscribe to the notion of poetic justice will be completely delighted by this idea, thinking that, you know, sport has to spend a couple hours rubbing off something that he did in a millisecond. What do they say to you, the kids? What kind of lessons do you think they're taking away from this?
Well, Actually, so the last fall when this began, I had four kids, and one of them was probably had the most prevalent was SAES, if you've seen that all around town, and he spent about 12 weeks with me. You know, the initial was the excitement of doing the graffiti and not getting caught, and a lot of them actually have their goal is to become an artist, and so this is the city's been like a canvas of their training, although it's on somebody else's property and it's illegal, and in some cases it doesn't look like art to me, but trying to work with them also as a role model for and keeping them further out of the juvenile justice system is a goal also.
All right. What about ones where perhaps the lesson stuck? Have you gotten a sense for some of them, their eyes were open?
Yes. And of the initial, actually, the two, and I will say SAES, who did the most damage, he's probably one of the hardest working young men and has, I think his goal is to go to an art school and do this in a positive way. We've also been fortunate to work with a neutral zone. Mary Thiefels, who's their visual art coordinator, who really helps us to direct these young folks into positive art and positive creation. And that's really our goal. It is, we're okay with expressing yourself, and there's great, canvas under the railroad trestles, and actually some businesses have offered their walls and to direct their energy and their artistic abilities on something positive.
Well, it certainly sounds like it truly, you don't often say win, 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 win all
right.
around, but this one seems to be. Sergeant Hickey, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Sergeant Thomas Hickey is with the Ann Arbor Police Department, and he created the Juvenile Graffiti Removal Project.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Look around the crowd at any Red Wings game. You'll see plenty of fans paying tribute to my next guest by wearing the number 24 jersey, even though it's been more than 5 years since this Hall of Famer skated for the Wings. No less an authority than Red Wings head coach Mike Babcock calls him the greatest American player of all time. Well, now we find out what his storied career was like from the inside, from number 24 himself. Chris Chelios' memoir is titled Made in America. Chris Chelios, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. So 26 seasons in the NHL, you're tied with Gordie Howe, you've got 3 Stanley Cups, Hockey Hall of Fame, and it all started for you at a really young age, it seems, growing up on Chicago's South Side. Do you remember your first time on the ice?
Yeah, I mean, it was in a park out about 2 blocks away from my house, a city called Evergreen Park, just on the border of Chicago in the suburbs. But yeah, you don't forget those days, and it's not like I grew up wanting to be a pro hockey player. I just played hockey because I loved it, and things actually worked out. So,
to say the least, you share with us a story from your Pee Wee hockey days, and as a parent, I read it twice to see if I read it right about how your dad Gus reacted when you weren't playing as well as you had been playing, and I think of how so many parents today are cheerleaders for their kids. They're focusing on the good stuff. They want to smooth over the bumps. Gus Chelios certainly took a different tack. Tell us what he said to you.
He had a lot of passion, whether it was on the ice, when I was on the ice, or I was working for him in the restaurant. So I'm going to be nice to my dad because he's still around to read the book and hear it. But he, you know, my whole thing, he wanted me to have a great work ethic. And that was pretty much what he was trying to get across to me, whether it was, you know, for sports or school or anything I decided I was going to do. So that's pretty much what he instilled in me from an early age.
He asked you, do you like hockey? And you said, yes, I like it. I like it very much. And then Gus says, then I'm going to be with you all the time telling you not the good things you do, but rather the bad things you do. And I thought, that's tough love.
Yeah, he was hard on me. And like I said, it taught me, you know, now that I have kids and they all played hockey or sports. And, you know, I try to approach it a different way than my father. Things are different now, obviously, than they were 30 years ago raising a kid. You got to be a little more sensitive, and it's just a different time. So for the most part, I think it helped me raise my kids and deal with, you know, when they had problems or, you know, when you wanted them to learn lessons. And I hope the book comes across for kids a little bit, and the fact that you do face adversity, you know, growing up, whether it's sports, school, anything, you know, you try to rise above it and get through it.
Yeah, well, he helped you, probably helped you toughen that hide so it was there when you got to the NHL. He moved with your moved your family from Chicago to the San Diego area in search of better restaurant opportunities. And certainly, he, you know, you were expected to pitch in and help with the family restaurant. At what point did you decide that, you know, working in the restaurant was not what you wanted in life?
You know what? I was actually going to college in San Diego at the time. I had to work for my father, you know, to help him out to make ends meet, basically. We weren't doing that great. That's why we moved to California to start a new business. But ultimately, what my dad did tell me was make sure you go to college, get your degree, so you don't end up working in the bar or restaurant the rest of your life like I am. And, you know, not that it didn't give us a good living. There were some good times and bad times. But, you know, it stuck in my mind, and for sure, I didn't want to end up in the kitchen for the rest of my life or managing a restaurant. But somehow I managed to get back to it. It's just a Greek thing, you know, having the place in Detroit. But like you said, I learned a lot of tough love. But at the end, you know, it all worked out, you know, for a reason.
Well, there you were in California in the late 1970s. And as you tell us in your book, the NHL was basically Canadian then. Americans had such a minor presence. And as you put, scouts and college recruiters weren't thinking of San Diego for prospects. You looked for vacation homes in California. You didn't look for hockey players. How did you make it from, you know, the beaches of San Diego to wind up on NHL ice?
Yeah, well, it's in the book, and honestly, it's just a fluke, right place at the right time. Ran into a kid that I had tried out with in San Diego for the college team and had gotten cut. And a month later, they were on the beach training. I went to say hi to him. He asked me where I was playing, and at that point, I was done playing, just going to school and working. He gave me the phone number of the coach in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, Larry Billows, made the call, and the rest is history. So, like I said, there's something to be said for timing and, you know, being in the right place at the right time.
And having the talent, because you did make it to the NHL, played for Montreal, then back home to Chicago until that 98-99 season, and then here to Detroit in 99. Before we talk about the move to Detroit, you write that playing in Montreal probably comes with the most pressure. Why is that?
Well, being in a Canadian city, the history of the Montreal Canadiens, their winning traditions, you know, you got guys like Rocket Richard, Guy Lafleur, Bob Gainey, mentioned the guys I played. You know, you're playing with them or they're in the building. And, you know, you can't help but put that added pressure on yourself about being successful and winning. So it was like, I always said it, I was like getting a Harvard degree when I broke in with Montreal. I learned from the best that ever played the game. And it kind of, you know, throughout the course of my career, you know, I used that when I got traded to Chicago as far as leadership. And then, you know, of course, to Detroit, having Steve Yzerman as a captain, you know, he ran the team. It was his team. And when he spoke, he wasn't often, but when he said something, it, you know, it sure meant a lot. So, like I said, I'm real fortunate to be surrounded by the players, Nick Lidstrom's, the veterans that I ended up with here in Detroit.
You know, you write that when the trade happened and you were traded, you know, you came to Detroit from Chicago, you had been the enemy, but things had changed in Chicago. You talked about the fact that Dirk Graham came in announcing he didn't want your kids in the dressing room, and you tell us you spent most of that 98-99 season, in your words, begging Graham to explain why he was treating me like a leper. And then you read in the paper where the GM says your contract would be your last contract. How is that as a feeling inside? Did you consider hanging it up and calling it a career at that point?
No, honestly, I knew I had some hockey left in me. Obviously, I felt the way things were going that I couldn't carry the load like I did, you know, getting into my age, getting a little older. At the time, you don't understand it. There's ways to do business and other ways. I have no ill feelings now towards any of those people that at the time were responsible for, you know, what happened. And Dirk Graham, I still consider a friend, a great teammate, great leader. But like I said, the book was a way of getting it off my chest to explain to some of the fans in Chicago. I felt like they were, you know, directly when they said that about the kids, it was targeted towards me and the writing was on the wall that it was time for me to go. But I just didn't feel, you know, I didn't feel it was that time to retire. So it all worked out well, obviously, coming to Detroit. And they did me the, you know, Mr. Wirtz did me a huge favor by sending me to Detroit. He didn't have to do that. And like I said, it couldn't have worked out any better.
And we all know in Detroit you had said it once, and you talk about this in your book, Chris Childers, that you had said in an interview you would never play for the Red Wings. And then, oh boy, the Red Wings wanted you. Talk to us about what it was like walking into Detroit's dressing room that first time.
Well, the word that comes to mind is comical. some of the looks, mostly like disbelief, like seeing me, you know, put on the jersey before warm-ups. And it had to look odd to them because when I went in to look at the mirror, to look at myself before I went out, just splash water on my hair and face, it didn't look right at all. But I got lucky. We were on such a good team. You know, I came in. Scotty put me in a situation where I couldn't fail on the ice. And I thank him for that. He put me in every situation to succeed. And, you know, we went into the end of the season winning 13 in a row, losing to Colorado in the playoffs. But like I said, I couldn't have been luckier for the fans to accept me after what had gone on the past 8 years before, all the hate for Chicago and myself. So real lucky, that's for sure. And then make Detroit my home now.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think that you you're part of the Red Wings front office. Your sons are skating for Michigan State. Shelley's Chili is part of the downtown scene. Although I did hear from listeners on Facebook who are so sorry it closed in Dearborn. They love the Dearborn location. I'll just throw that in there. But why did you stay in Michigan? Did you surprise yourself by not heading back to Chicago?
In all honesty, it was a family decision. I had kids in high school, like you mentioned, kids in college. It was for the kids. I love Chicago. I'm there quite a bit. My parents are still there. So, you know, a couple times my parents have had some scares health-wise, and it's really hard. As close as Chicago is to Detroit, it's not the same as being there for them. So I found it real difficult to commute when they needed to get to the hospital, or someone being the oldest son, they'd only listen to me to go to the hospital. So that was the biggest issue. Like I said, the kids, now they're all graduated, we're empty nested, but I couldn't be happier working for the Ilitchers and the Detroit Red Wings and Kenny. I'm in a great situation, and I've always appreciated what they've done for me. So right now I'm very content in Michigan and traveling back and forth to Grand Rapids and Chicago occasionally.
I'm talking with Hall of Famer Chris Chelios about his book, Made in America. And Chris, we saw you hoisting the Stanley Cup, actually in 2002 at the Joe. I was there that night watching that happen, and it was a magical night. Happened again in 2008, and you'd already won the Cup with Montreal in 86. Can you give us a feeling of what it is like to take that victory lap around the ice after you've battled so hard and finally won the Cup?
Well, there's no bigger stage, and I won in my second year, and said, "Geez, this is easy. I'm gonna pile up a whole lot of rings here." And then 17 years later, 2002, I think it was the biggest spread between someone winning a cup. Winning it at home was unreal. In Montreal, we won it in Calgary. Not to take anything away, winning a cup in Montreal, I don't think there's any bigger event. Having over a million people at the parade and going down St. Catherine, but winning it at home, having kids old enough to understand it, sharing it with my family, which I didn't do the first time because I had no kids. There's nothing like winning a championship at any level, but when you're in the NHL and you're that level and sharing it with the fans and the city, and it's something special. Anybody will tell you when they won the cup, and being able to take the cup, you know, for a couple of days and sharing that with your friends, it's a great tradition.
What's your favorite taking the cup somewhere story?
You know, I guess not to name drop, but when I took it out to Malibu, just because I felt like I'd been out there for, 17 years, and I built enough friendships and friends out there. I had a party, basically an open party on the beach, and every time I turned around, it was a different celebrity who I didn't invite. They just happened to hear that the Stanley Cup was down on the beach, and they wanted to go see it and get a picture with it. So, you know, when Sylvester Stallone shows up to your party, you know it's a good one. So, I had Tom Hanks and the guy Meathead, Rob Reiner from All in the Family. So, like I said, that was a special moment. Rafes came out, Cleary, Puddler, a couple other guys made it out there. It was Darren McCarty. So that sticks out in my mind, Wayne Gretzky. It was a really great day for a lot of people.
I think a lot of folks would have liked to have been at that party, Chris. You know, speaking of McCarty, it brings to mind some of the legendary NHL fighters, Probert, Joey Koser, Ty Domi. The game has really changed from when you started. Do you think hockey's gotten a little too gentrified as the NHL cleaned it up and eliminated most of the fights?
Well, whether it's gentrified, that's a great word, but they're obviously, I think the goal ultimately is to protect the players. That's why I think fighting's under the microscope. If you think about it, it is still the only pro sport that allows fighting. Kind of barbaric, but I think when you have a stick in your hands, the best way to settle it is to drop the gloves. I still think the reason why guys are getting hurt in fights now is just the players are so big and strong and fast and, you know, training and whatever it is they're eating, the stuff they're putting in the food. But it's ultimately a plan to protect the players, which I'm in favor of. But I still think it's a big part of the game from a fan's perspective. You know, everybody's out of their chair when there's a fight. There's times to fight. There's, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, you know, you fought for a reason. The guys that were supposed to fight, the guys, there was a code of respect. And I think now the players are losing that. And I think the problem is the guys in the suits that are running in the league, they shouldn't be making these decisions. It should be the players.
I have to say, I loved your quote. You said when you walked into that that Wings dressing room the first time, Darren McCarty picked up your stick and said, "This is the first time I've ever been this close to one of these without it being broken over my head." It was a good line.
Yeah, well, like I said, Mac, I was always aware he was on the ice. I went after Sergey and Stevie quite a bit. So when I did that, I knew who was coming. It was either Mac or Proby. So like I said, there's a mutual respect, and he was a great teammate, Mac. And I'm sure the people in he's so well-loved in Detroit for what he did and how he was such a hard-nosed, you know, pail. He took his, you know, lunch pail to work, and he worked and fought and scored some big goals.
Boy, you're right about that. We actually talked with him when his book came out, and it was a great conversation. How did it feel when you read the words from Mike Babcock that said you are, Chris Chelios, is the greatest American player of all time? How'd that feel?
Well, honestly, I didn't even notice it until my daughter mentioned it to me, because I haven't read the whole book, kind of nervous, and my wife hasn't read it either. She's afraid to see what's in there. But like I said, I only wish I could have gotten to have Babs when I was a younger player and a marquee guy. At the end, it was kind of a transition time for me. At first, I was the guy to bring along the young guys, but I still thought, and that's just the competitiveness in me, I thought I could do more to help the team. And when we were winning, I had nothing to say. When we were losing, I thought, you know, I could help on the power play. I did it my whole career. But, you know, we had guys like Rafalski, and we had guys that were so good at the time. You know, I couldn't justify, you know, fitting into those slots. And when I did get the opportunity with Babs, I got hurt, broke my leg twice. And things didn't go well for me. And then at the end, like I said, no bitterness. It's just an old athlete going down, and I think I went down with, you know, dignity and a player's respect. So it all worked out great. I think I frustrated him like hell, because I was the worst practice player in the world, and it drove him nuts because he was so much about structure and accountability. But no question, yeah, a great coach for the Wings.
Yeah, yeah, and you seem to click very well with Scotty Bowman.
Yeah, I caught him at the right time, too. I think I've had a run into him early in my career. Stories I hear from, you know, Larry Robinson and Bob Gainey and those guys that played from in the 70s, he was a tough cookie. But when I got to him, you know, he had a veteran team. He loved his veterans. He was hard on the young guys. And I really enjoyed playing for Scott. He was never a dull moment, a lot of laughs, whether he knew we were laughing or not. So it was good.
You know, I look at someone like Yzerman, who's now general manager. Do you see yourself, you know, where do you see yourself going with hockey? You're part of the Red Wings front office. You're working with Ken Holland. Do you see yourself ever coaching or higher in management?
You know, I did the front office thing for 2 years, working under two of the best in Jim Nill and Kenny Holland. And I just thought I wanted to try something different, you know, wearing a suit every day and then having to go in an office and critique the players. You know, and I wasn't separated enough from the team, my teammates, to go in there and tell them, this guy's had a bad game, this guy shouldn't be in the lineup. And I was really uncomfortable, you know, feeling like I was still part of the team and actually still feeling like I was a player. So I went to, you know, developing players, going to Grand Rapids, learning how to coach under Jeff Lashill. And I've been doing that for 2 or 3 years. So right now it seems like if I was to take a full-time job, I think coaching would be the way I'd go. It just seems like you're so in touch with the players and you're in the room, you're on the ice. And I really enjoy teaching the young guys and not having to, you know, decide their fate, you know, of their careers.
The book is Made in America by Chris Chelios with USA Today's Kevin Allen. And Chris Chelios will be signing his book Tuesday night at Barnes & Noble on Washtenaw in Ann Arbor from 7 to 9 p.m. And by the way, if you're at the Joe Friday night, he will be signing from 6 to 7:30 at Section 104. Chris Chelios, it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Intersex fish, birds on Prozac. While high-profile chemical spills and algae blooms have raised concerns about the safety of drinking water in the U.S., there's another kind of runoff in water affecting the environment, one we can't see. The medicines we take pass through our bodies and eventually end up in the water supply, or we flush old meds down the toilet. In this report for the BBC, chemist Andrea Sella of the University College London looks at how our drugs are ending up in the environment.
This is one of those wind-in-the-willows riverbanks. There are ducks on the water, fish are jumping out from time to time, and there are beautiful flowers on the riverbank. But as I look into the water as a chemist, I've got to ask, what is there in the water as well as the stuff we can see? Every day, across the world, billions of us take pharmaceuticals like antidepressants, headache pills, and contraceptives. What happens to these drugs after they've served their purpose in our bodies?
In the case of pharmaceuticals, probably the key finding was so-called intersex fish.
Professor John Sumpter from Brunel University was one of the first biologists to study these male fish with female characteristics when they were noticed in the 1990s.
The first finding was that lots of fish in rivers had in their blood a protein a scientist would call vitellogenin, but publicly probably call it yolk. And the synthesis of the yolk in the liver is under the control of estrogens. And what was found was that male fish, which don't make estrogen to any significant extent, and therefore don't have yolk, we found very, very high concentrations of yolk, extraordinary high concentrations, in fish, in the wild, in the UK, particularly ones that live close or just downstream of a sewage treatment plant.
John and his colleagues asked themselves what could be causing these intersex fish to develop.
Because it's something to do with sex, if it's partial to the sex of the fish, then it's very sensible to say, well, that could be a hormone, and it's quite likely to be a sex hormone. And all of the data actually suggested that male fish were being feminized rather than female fish being masculinized to produce the intersex. So if it's male fish being feminized, then it's likely to be an estrogen.
Sure enough, their work through the 90s showed that drugs such as female contraceptives were feminizing fish. As a result, water treatment processes in the UK were improved. I visited Monica Jurgens from the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology at a river near Oxford, where she was collecting water samples.
We're now about a mile or so downstream of the sewage works, and we're taking more samples here. Most of that flow that we can see is actually sewage effluent rather than rainwater.
This water looks, you know, it looks pretty clear.
Well, it is actually quite nice, and you do have quite a lot of fish swimming in there. I don't know if you can see any at the moment, but the quality of the water is pretty good.
What steps have been taken to clean up the water?
I think all sewage works in the UK have been improved since then. And at that time, the worst effects were seen downstream of sewage works, which only had primary treatment. Primary treatment means you let the sewage settle, you take the solids out somewhere else, and that's it. Nowadays, we have secondary treatment as a minimum everywhere. Secondary treatment means biological treatment, so we basically speed up the natural degradation processes that would otherwise happen in the river and do them before it hits the river.
All this effort has improved the quality of water in our rivers substantially. But despite that, traces of all sorts of pharmaceuticals do still get through wastewater treatment plants. John Sumpter again.
We know that lots of chemicals, thousands, probably tens of thousands, are present in the effluent from sewage treatment plants and entering rivers. probably the biggest concern at the moment is, or are, pharmaceuticals that affect behaviour in people. So you're talking about drugs that are taken for depression or anti-anxiety drugs or something like that. These are present in the environment, without a doubt. Very low concentrations, but they're there. And there's quite a substantial amount now of published information claiming that these drugs at low concentrations within the environmental range are affecting behaviour of a range of organisms.
Stateside's partner, Professor Andrea Sella, reporting for the BBC. Let's turn now to Rebecca Clapper. Rebecca's been studying the presence of pharmaceuticals and personal care products, or PPCPs, within the Great Lakes. She's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences, and she's with us now from Milwaukee. Rebecca, looking at Lake Huron in Michigan, how many trillions of gallons of water do these connected lakes have?
Yeah, they are really large bodies of water, and much larger than what, you know, what other lakes and streams have, that where we found these medications before. And so it's kind of surprising. It surprised us that we were able to detect some of these compounds out into Lake Michigan.
So all along we've been kind of thinking, with all those trillions of gallons of water, we only need to worry about the water right around the treatment plant discharge points, and you find now not so much.
Yeah, we're finding that some of the pharmaceuticals and other emerging contaminants, so things that are either new chemicals to the marketplace or things that we're just now able to detect. So pharmaceuticals kind of fall into that. We've been using them for decades, but now we have methods to detect them down to very tiny concentrations, which is really what we find compared to what you would take as a pill. It's much smaller than what anybody would take as a medication. But we do find them going out several miles out into the lake, and we have not started work going out looking in the middle of the lake. We don't know how far away it goes, but definitely, you know, within several miles of the shore, we're definitely finding these things.
And give us an idea of the things you found, Rebecca.
We're finding everything from antibiotics, so medications you take, you know, when you're sick with a bacterial infection, to some of the antiseptics that you find in your hand soaps. They're called triclosan and triclocarban, and some of the anti-anxiety medications, the things that you take for depression and other things like that, like Prozac you mentioned, and the diabetes drug metformin or glucophage that people take for type 2 diabetes is another one, and then several other types of chemicals as well.
And what worries you about this, first of all, looking at effects on the fish?
So one of the things, and one of the reasons actually that we did the study looking at what we find out in the lake, is we were wondering what kind of exposures were fish coming in contact to out in the lake. And, you know, the dose really makes the poison. You got to figure out how much something is getting exposed in order to figure out what kind of effects it might have. So, you know, although we detect lots of these at trace levels, so in the nanogram per liter range to the microgram per liter, and remember, you're taking these medications usually in the hundreds to thousands of milligram dose. So does it really have an effect on it at that low level? And so our concern is that, you know, especially the pharmaceuticals, they're designed to act on very specific pathways in your body to fix what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, you know, do they also push those same pathways in fish? And we're finding that even at low doses, some of these chemicals, not all of them, but some of them do have an impact at lower concentrations.
What kind of impact?
One of the things that we care about, particularly in fish, is whether it's having some kind of impact on their reproduction. So, you know, in humans, we generally care about things like, we care about reproduction, but also cancer and small things that might be wrong with a human. In fish populations, we care, is that fish population going to crash? And usually that boils down to, is there some kind of reproductive effect on the fish? And so we've looked at a couple of medications. One is Prozac, like you mentioned, and we're finding that and some concentrations of some of the anti-anxiety, anti-depression medications, we do find impacts on fish behavior. And since it's a medication that's supposed to affect behavior, that's kind of one of the things that you would probably look for. And the most important thing is that it's affecting reproductive behavior. The paper that we published showed that it's not necessarily having an effect at the concentration we find out in the lake. But one of the things that we're concerned about is that there are many of those medications that act on similar pathways, and if you added them all up, would they end up having some kind of impact? So that one in particular. And metformin's another one where we've done some reproductive assays, and we're finding some reproductive effects, and we're still in the middle of that study. And for that one, we're more concerned because we're finding some impacts down at lower concentrations that are really environmentally relevant. That's what's coming out of the treatment plant. that.
And so I wonder, Rebecca, what do we make of this? Because we know that people aren't going to stop taking medications they need, and we know that that waste has to go somewhere, whether it is, you know, excreted through urine or people are carelessly disposing of old medications by flushing them away. What needs to happen to change this?
That's the million-dollar question, actually the billions-of-dollar question. One of the places that people generally point to is the sewage treatment plant, and the upgrades that would be necessary in order to remove all these chemicals from our sewage treatment plant, from each sewage treatment plant, is in the, you know, millions of dollars. And if you look across the country, you know, it's billions of dollars. So the question is there something else that we can do, or are there cheaper treatments that we could put in place? Or are there changes in behavior or changes in the chemistry of the medications that we're prescribing that would then change them so they don't have that impact on organisms? And people are kind of exploring all those options. One of the issues is that there hasn't been a concerted effort to kind of gather all of those types of questions together. People are kind of working on them one by one. So, for example, Milwaukee was one of the first to start doing take-back events for pharmaceuticals that weren't being used. And now this is spread across the country. So here they have a medicine collection day, and now it's progressed to you can drop things off at the police station or at the pharmacy. The FDA changed some of the regulations with the federal government as far as those take-back events so that pharmacies can start taking these medications back so they don't get dumped down the toilet is one. Our sewage treatment plant here has also been investigating different treatment technologies. So is there a cheap way that we could take care of more of these chemicals by altering what we do at the treatment plant? So people are exploring all sorts of different options. I think the big question is, which of these chemicals do we need to make sure that are not there anymore? Because you know, there are hundreds of them that are coming out of the treatment plant at very low concentrations, but we really have very little grasp on which ones are really the ones of concern.
And there you're so looking, going, you know, year after year after year with this being pumped out. You're right. It's a big question mark.
Yeah, without knowing which ones are of most concern, you don't know whether your treatment technology has taken care of the problem. And there's very little funding right now. We kind of scrape together stuff. Our sewage treatment plan actually has been our major funder for a lot of the research that we've done on these emerging contaminants because they're very concerned. They can see the writing on the wall that they're going to have to take care of this somehow and be involved in the solution. But that's not a common thing. And there's not a big concerted effort to really evaluate some of these compounds.
Well, it certainly sounds as if, researchers like you are trying to do the science and figure out what's there and what the impact is. The rest of us could certainly do our part by being very careful about how we dispose of prescriptions and non-prescription, over-the-counter drugs as well.
Yeah, and there are some chemicals that we can, stop using. Triclosan and triclocarban are those two that I mentioned that are antiseptics and hand soap, and you find them in a lot of things, actually, as antimicrobial agents. And research has shown from the CDC that using those in your soap is not really very protective. It doesn't do anything more than the actual soap does. So washing your hands with warm, soapy water. And so not using products that have those compounds in them is something that we could do right now, and it doesn't hurt us, and it makes a better case for the environment. And, properly disposing of medications is another one. And not demanding antibiotics from the doctor every time you go just because you're a little sick. We know that if you have a viral infection, the antibiotics aren't really going to help anyway. So decreasing use of things where we can.
Rebecca, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for your interest.
Rebecca Clapper is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. Pretty safe to say you can barely walk across a street in Michigan without stepping on a manhole cover branded East Jordan Iron Works. This company has a 131-year history in Michigan.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Tom Teske is with EJ. He's vice president and general manager of the Americas. Tom, when I think of the 1800s in Michigan, when this company began, I think lumber. So how did the East Jordan Iron Works come to be?
The company did start in East Jordan supplying parts to the lumbering industry, which was very active in 1883 when they started in northern Michigan.
Tell us a little about the founder.
The founder, W.E. Malpass, was an immigrant from England, and he met his future bride, who was the daughter of R.W. Round, who was a principal in Traverse City Iron Works, who helped him start East Jordan Iron Works.
And now the lumbering era faded, the glory days passed. How did the company then adapt?
The company transitioned to making municipal castings and fire hydrants and valves in the teens in 1914-15 and started making products for the growing marketplace in Detroit.
Now, we fast forward to 2014, and, you know, anyone with their eye to the ground in Michigan knows that name that is on the manhole covers. Where else do your manhole covers exist?
Well, we produce them in the U.S., in Michigan and in Oklahoma, and we have sales branches and distribution centers throughout the country that supply almost most of the major markets in the U.S. and Canada. And then throughout the world, we also have a production facility in Europe, which supplies France and neighboring countries.
There really are lessons to be learned from the 1800s that businesses today can look at to see a company that met a need, and when that need began to fade, you know, got adept and, you know, adapted.
Oh, certainly. And we continue to grow and evolve by providing various types of access solutions. Now we not only make them in iron, we also have an aluminum hatch division. We have invested in composites. And so we produce all different types of access covers, which as we call them now, for openings in the ground, basically. So,
when you think of EJ's 131-year history and legacy, you know, in the west side of Michigan, you've still got the company family-owned, fourth generation of Malpasses. Why stay in Michigan?
Well, I think it was started here, and I think the family is both in fourth and fifth generation now, and it's committed to both being a family business, and they're committed especially to northern Michigan and living here and working here and investing in the community and the state. So.
And one would think that if W.E. was around to walk through the offices today, he'd have to be very impressed.
Yeah, we think W.E. would be very proud of what the family business has achieved today, and their continued growth and reinvestment and plan to continue to grow and survive in a tough global environment.
Tom Teske, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Hey, thanks a lot.
One step toward fighting blight in Flint is about to happen thanks to more than 150 donors who kicked in over $10,000. Back in August, we talked on Stateside to Gordon Young. His goal was to raise that $10,000 to tear down a single decaying home on Park Belt Drive in Flint. Gordon noted one abandoned house drags down a whole neighborhood, and rather than wait for the city of Flint and the Genesee County Land Bank to find the money, Gordon launched an Indiegogo campaign. It worked. Donors contributed everything from $1 to $1,000 to reach the goal and exceed it by over $1,000. Word came today the abandoned house at 6608 Park Belt Drive is set for demolition tomorrow morning at 8:30. No tears will be shed. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.